This is Johnny Bluestar. Welcome to Threshold, a global media event. Is the universe just a random dance of atoms? Or is it a manifestation of a supremely intelligent architect? Can its purpose, or our purpose here on Earth, be adequately assessed? Can we commune with it, know its intentions, cooperate with its direction? Here, we define Threshold as a gateway state of awareness, allowing mankind to cross into a place of real cognition. Threshold allows us to approach questions of higher reality through the door of experience rather than mere belief. Welcome to Threshold, where we tear away the veil from commercial media, bringing our audience and participants into another realm of reality and enhanced communication. We now return to our exciting interview conducted over a period of months with Korean War veteran and crime fighter Ray Boylan. One of the things I found most interesting to explore was Ray's perspective as a Marine during and after the war. There is no question that Ray was embroiled in a minute-to-minute battle for his life for many months under extremely unpleasant, frigid climate conditions, often exposed to the unnerving, psychologically upsetting sound of bugles and whistles, an essential component of the Chinese invasion. Let's continue with our interview.
Well, Ray, I wanted to ask you, having fought in the Korean War, what were your impressions, your general impressions of that war? Like, looking at it from the standpoint of the people who created the defense of South Korea, you know, people in our country and in South Korea, and the North Koreans and the people who fought on the ground. What is your impression in general about the war?
Well, I really never felt that I was fighting for America, but I felt I was stopping communism. It's the North Koreans overran the South Koreans, and the North Koreans are a communist country, and we were sent there by the UN. So it never really, I never really thought I would fight for USA like World War II. However, I did feel I did my part in stopping the communism overrunning South Korea.
So, what do you think of what North Korea became? What do you think of it now?
Well, it became quite a power, and it's quite a threat to the world at this time. And I hope things will go a little lighter. And they can see their way to try to develop some peace.
Yeah, it's funny because, like you were saying, in the past, it really wasn't a direct threat to the United States. It was a threat to the you might say the free world at the time, because all those countries were, you know, dropping left and right to communism.
Yeah.
But now, paradoxically, decades later, it is a threat. It's an actual threat to our country as well as many other countries.
Oh, absolutely.
And it to me, it seems like it's almost a threat. I mean, I think the communist Chinese are a little bit concerned as well.
I think they should be.
Yeah. Well, I just have never seen any kind of, I don't think there's ever been a country that made such definite threats verbally against the United States and other countries using nuclear weapons as their, device to make that threat.
Yeah.
And it's also amazing to me that they're still there.
Oh, yeah. It's a threat.
What do you think that, from your observations, how do you think the people in North Korea feel?
Well, I don't think they really want to get involved in world domination. I think they may be communists, but I think they're decent people, and they really not interested in having a war.
Right. They're probably more interested in being able to have enough to eat.
That's right. That's right.
Or making sure that their family members don't go to some kind of prisoner of war camp.
That's right. It's not a rich country, so people are mostly in the lower level.
Yeah. So, What would you recommend? Do you think our foreign policy is correct in North Korea right now, or do you think it should be modified in some way?
Well, I really don't know. I think that we should try to get together a little more and talk some peace and try to bring them around.
Seems really, really, really rather difficult, I would say.
Oh, yes.
Well, so in a general way, I guess we accomplished some of our goals back then in the Korean War, but really we didn't push very far. In other words, we really got back to a kind of neutral situation, didn't we?
Yeah, we still maintain the 38 parallel, and each is right there. They're minding their own business for now.
Going back to the war itself, since actually at one point you landed on Incheon Harbor, not too long after MacArthur's rather magnificent invasion. And what did people there in on the ground think about Incheon and what MacArthur did?
Well, there was no great love for MacArthur by the Marines, but anyway, he was a great military leader, and I guess because we were landed at Incheon to cut off the escaping North Koreans from, they almost made it to Pusan, and we landed a regiment of Marines at Pusan, and they were pushing them north, and we were going to cut them off. So I think that was good.
Well, you know, MacArthur made certain claims to Truman about the impossibility, or the unlikelihood anyway, of the Chinese invading North Korea. And what was the reaction of people on the ground to that? I mean, was there genuine surprise, or did many people not really believe that MacArthur was right when you started to push up north?
Well, all the guys around me believed that we should push north and get them out of North Korea. And, of course, the Chinese, we're looking at now, to chase them back to Manchuria. So I thought, and most of the Marines I served with thought he was right.
That they wouldn't invade in the first place.
Yeah.
So it was sort of a surprise.
Oh, yes. I think I was notified November 2nd that the Chinese crossed the border.
From the time the Chinese crossed the border to the time that you actually confronted them, how many days took place?
Well, I'd say 10 days. We started to receive fire from the Chinese, and that would make it the 12th. And then from the 12th on, we were engaged most of the time with fire. And on November 27th is the day that we and my company were engaged in hand-to-hand combat. Of course, I was not engaged right away, but I could see across the hill that some of my company was fighting them hand to hand.
Had you fought hand to hand before in the war?
No, I never, not hand to hand. No.
Now, you know, the famous story about the invasion is the bugles and the whistles, right? Did you hear those bugles and whistles?
Oh, plenty of bugles and whistles, and we thought they were using them for psychology to demoralize us, and it did. Of course, I found out later that the bugles and the whistles were signals to their own men to commit a certain act, to either move to the right or go forward or charge, whatever.
Oh, really? But
they were geary, weary sounds.
What were the whistles like? Were they like cop whistles or something, or what were they like?
Yeah, they were cop whistles. Just like the kids have whistles today. They blow them three times for a certain movement, and whatever they were doing, I didn't know their commands, but they sure spooked us.
I see. Well, I think that they also use some kind of subterfuge sometimes, like they had English-speaking communists talk to the, you know, pretend they were South Koreans or something. Did you hear any of that?
No, I didn't hear any of that, Johnny.
Okay. Well, that whole period of time, how would you say it helped you? I mean, grow or understand things better? What was the upside of the experience?
Well, I felt since I was able to return home in one piece, that I had some kind of an experience that very few people get to have, but I was lucky to be alive. And I thought that the UN was trying to make more peace over there, and that's what I was interested in, that the two countries would be peaceful together.
Why don't we just talk just for a minute about the work we did on that novel?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, sure. I'm not 100% familiar with everybody in there because the names didn't stick in my head.
But that's okay. See, we took this the background of the movie from a lot of things that actually happened to you.
Yeah, I know.
And we kind of blew them up. What was it like to actually see yourself and some of the events in your life portrayed fictionally as well as actually as they happened, as it was done in West Side Warrior?
Well, I enjoyed writing or putting my thoughts down and reading your thoughts in the novel. It gave me a real outlook on what a good novel could be.
Yeah, it was sort of like I found the your story so intriguing that I kept seeing these fictional scenes. At some point, we sort of made a transition, and then we thankfully made a transition back and finished and published West Side Warrior.
Yeah.
But it was quite an interesting experience because I never written anything that was fictional that was so close to reality in some ways, and yet quite different. And I found it interesting to see whole scenes appearing in my mind that were connected with your life, but they were not really part of your life. They were really created.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, sure. It was very interesting.
Did you feel like when you were when you got into combat, was there from the beginnings in boot camp to your going out and working with the Marines in training in amphibious warfare, from all that until you got into combat, was it fairly much a straight line? I mean, were you fully prepared for what you experienced when you actually entered into combat?
Oh, well, as I say in my book, that when I first landed, I felt like I was on a maneuver. And although there were a few snipers around in the area of Incheon Beach, when we went forward and I walked past Kimpo Airport, there was a bloody battle there, and I saw all these North Korean soldiers half buried, and I could see their faces, and I says, "This is for real." I finally got the visualization that I'm in a dangerous situation, and it's going to be me or him sooner or later.
When you enlisted and during the time you were in training, did you really think you would be going into combat?
No, never, never. I was in about 20 months, 24 months before Korea broke out. And it was all peacetime training, and I was in a reconnaissance company where we were out on the beach most of the time in rubber boats and actually enjoying it. But I was in the Mediterranean on occupation duty when in June when Korea broke out. And eventually, of course, sometime about early September, we were shipped to Japan to train, get additional training to go to combat in Korea.
So it was kind of a shock.
Yes, it was. I never thought I'd be going to war, but I never was afraid. I always thought, well, I'm going to be okay, and I'm going to get home in one piece.
We go to a break with a beautiful love theme composed by Edgar Ahrens.
Thank you.
This is Johnny Blue Star. I've worked as a lyricist with Patricia Welsh for over 5 years, along with Russian composer Edgar Ahrens, a friend and colleague. Her ability as a singer is simply amazing. She brings a unique and dramatic flair to every song she sings. Over the next few months, we shall be releasing a number of these songs, part of an album called Hadley's Castle. Meanwhile, Patricia has been busy creating a super enjoyable collection of classic standards in an exciting 46-song, 3-CD collection.
Music for Great Entertaining introduces Cocktails, Dinner, and Dessert with Patricia Welsh. 3 hours of continuous music. 46 of the all-time classic standards, spanning decades of hit songs. Going to a friend's home for dinner? Cocktails, Dinner, and Dessert with Patricia also makes the perfect hostess gift. This 3-CD compilation is the perfect background music that sets just the right mood for any dinner party.
I'm crazy for feeling so lonely. There was a boy, a very strange, enchanted boy.
To purchase this album, just go to patriciawelch.com/CD. That is patriciawelch.com/CD. You won't be disappointed.
It is the 15th century. El Tesoro de Cielo, a Spanish treasure ship, sends a scouting expedition to a strange island. Golden statues surrounding them prove the enormity of their find. Suddenly, hordes of ghoulish creatures with scaly green flesh and skeletal wings descend upon them from the sky.
What do you think of this, Rufio?
These creatures are fragile, Captain. We could take them with our swords.
They seem supernatural. Who knows what powers they possess?
Fallen angels, weakened by their treason.
My God! Are you saying they're Nephilim, the devil's host?
I'm saying, whatever they are, we can take them. Do any of you cowards dare join me?
Up against sharp knife-like nails and hideous fangs, the men's swords rip into slimy green flesh. Though black blood pours copiously from their half-naked bodies, creatures miraculously persist. Can the crew survive this bloody, cursed battle?
Find out more by Googling The Thrice Born, a new sci-fi supernatural novel by Carlos Lopez Avery and Johnny Bluestar. Google with the words Carlos Johnny Kendall, The Thrice Born. That's Carlos Johnny Kendall, The Thrice Born.
Well, Ray, I thought for a few minutes we would, in this interview, we'd focus on your crime-fighting activities. And you had a very long and exciting career, but at one point in your career, you had to deal with unions. This was a time of great turmoil for the unions. Could you tell us about that experience you had?
Well, one of the experiences I had with unions was the waterfront of New York Harbor, the AFL-CIO union. I was working for the Waterfront Commission at the time as a trainee investigator, and the regular investigators used to use me to follow longshoremen off the piers to see where they would be going. Most of them were bookies. And I also drove an undercover surveillance truck where two investigators would be in the back, and I would take the truck to an ideal observation point, and they would take movies of various criminal activities going on. And then I, during a major strike of the CIO in New York, Waterfront Commission, Waterfront Union, I was sent out to take movies of all the action taking place against the police. I got some very good movies. And then I also sat on a wiretap of a very notorious Brooklyn Waterfront Union member. So, except for when I worked for the DA's office, I worked on a guy named Johnny Dio, who was used to extort from unions. That's my extent of union work.
Wasn't there a time that that you had taken some tape and they found out, some of these gangsters found out that you had taken the tape?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Me and another fella went to photograph longshoreman hanging out on a corner in New Jersey. And we were in the basement of a United Parcel building. And they spotted us. So about five of them came in. And I thought I was going to get my head handed to me, but all they wanted was the tape. So my partner handed them a tape. And then they left. And then he said to me, "Ray, I gave them a blank tape. We still got the movies we came to get. Let's get out of here." And so I laughed all the way back to the office.
Well, one of the things that really impressed me was, remember that there was a big gangster convention. This was the time the mafia, at the time the mafia was not really known as being the mafia. It was kind of, to the public, it was kind of an amorphous gangland type of activity. But there was a big kind of meeting that you actually were involved in. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, my involvement in that was the Appalachian meeting of a bunch of 63 organized crime mafia members. Now, my part of it was when I went to work for the DA's office, they gave me a couple of mediocre jobs just to start off, and one of them was to track toll calls, telephone toll calls of major New York mafia members. And then after about 3 months, I noticed that too many calls were going to each of them too many times. So I brought it to the attention of my boss, and he said, "Well, let's send it up to the DA in the Appalachian area." So we sent it up to the DA in the Appalachian area. And of course, the rest is history. The DA assigned the state police to check on it. And within a few days, they spotted so many cars, Cadillacs and limousines, from out of state in the hotels in the town. And then it was to turn out that the 63 members were having a meeting at another mafia member who had owned a Canada Dry company. And the meeting went on until they spotted the troopers outside circling the building. So they all ran out to beat it. And most of them ran through the woods, and some of them tried to drive out, but they were stopped by the state troopers. And a unique thing that they found guns and large amounts of money in the woods where these fellows had dropped them off so they wouldn't get caught with them. But all 63 members were captured and interviewed, but only one received a slight offense charge, and all the rest were let go.
Why did they let them go? Was it just that they didn't really have anything on them?
No, they had nothing on them. They didn't. At that time, we didn't know why they were holding the meeting, or what they said at the meeting, or we had no information on the meeting itself. And none of them out of the 63 would tell us, or tell the state police. So they had to let them go.
Well, so what was the aftermath of that? Wasn't that the scene that was celebrated more or less in The Godfather, where they busted this, where they came in and busted this meeting, this convention?
Well, I don't recall that, Johnny. Not such a large convention being in the movie. I think they busted in a bar in Brooklyn, but I don't know.
No, there was at some point there was a meeting. Well, anyway, tell us something about the process of surveillance that you used when you were out. You know, you see a lot of movies with surveillance. Do the movies reflect what really happens?
Well, for the most part, of course, it's the movies, you know. But what I did, foot surveillance is one thing, and vehicle surveillance is another. I did an awful lot of foot surveillance, working with maybe two or three other members, following on the streets of New York and of Manhattan mostly, because I was with the DA's office and they covered Manhattan. And then when I went to the Treasury Department, I did an awful lot of vehicle surveillance. In the beginning, we were following bootleggers, and they are very sharp when it comes to spotting people following them. So we used various different methods, and one was what they call parallel. You would follow them on a parallel street going the same way and watch them to cross the intersection, so you'd never be behind them. And another was we had various devices that would lead us to wherever they went. Also, I have to say that I really learned a lot about vehicle surveillance in the Treasury Department following bootleggers.
Well, in this process of surveillance, did you ever encounter some real danger?
I can't say I did. My job was to follow and not to get involved with the person driving, unless he's a bootlegger, and we were following him to take a still. Plus, one time I got a still with a pistol in it. I carried a pistol for his own good safety, not to kill anybody, but that was pretty much my danger. Of course, I had the incidents where I became accidentally involved in a stick-up once.
Oh, really?
Excuse me?
I said, oh, really?
Yeah, down by Katz's Deli. We were working.
Katz's Deli, that was around for a long time later, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah, it's still there, I think.
Very then, good pastrami sandwich.
That's right. We were eating dinner in there because we were working on the Elizabeth Street Mafia. And a guy ran up to him, must have spotted us as cops, and said, that guy just stuck me up. He's got a gun. So we saw the guy running down the block, and then he ducked down into a basement. Then we saw a police car come down with his red light going, but of course he didn't see the guy. So my partner, Mike Levine, went down after the guy came out of the basement. Sorry, I'm getting mixed up. After the guy came out of the basement, he started to head back toward us. And as soon as he got near me, I banged him against the wall and searched him. And we found in his pants a lumberman's axe that was covered with newspaper to keep from cutting himself, which he had in his pants. So, and then Mike Marine went down to the basement and found a handle of a movie camera that looked like a gun. So anyway, we turned this guy over to the local precinct. And as a matter of fact, I got an incentive award. Me and Mike got an incentive award. So things you run into by accident, you know, in the streets, that was one. And then another time we were working on bootleggers that were bank robbers. And sometimes we'd be following them, and they would be not only bank robbers.
Well, besides surveillance, you were also part of a group of people who were protecting the presidents, right?
Oh, yes. After President Kennedy got killed and his brother got killed, we were assigned presidential protection, and we would go with them while they were in New York to various dinners and be assigned in the area by the Secret Service.
You were basically part of the Treasury Department at the time, correct?
Yes, it was U.S. Treasury Department. But we received protection duties from the Secret Service.
Tell us about the time that you had to guard Nixon.
Oh, Nixon was great. He went to watch get a command performance of Yankee Doodle in a Broadway theater. And me and my partner, Tony Barkas, were stationed up in one of the booths on the side of the building. And he was sitting down there watching the show with his two daughters and his wife. And, of course, we were very aware while we were up there. We were always checking the back area to make sure nobody would get in. That was it, Johnny.
Why were you on that particular team? Why were you appointed to that presidential security position?
Well, the time came when they put protection on every candidate and every embassy. So the Secret Service couldn't cover it all by themselves. And we used to be assigned whenever a candidate or a presidential member came into New York City, we would be called in to help them do the protection job.
I think you also were involved with Hubert Humphrey, right?
Oh, yes. Hubert Humphrey was a great guy. And I was with him every time he came to New York and went with him to various celebrations. And I drove an open convertible to have the press so they could be jumping in and out of the car and taking pictures when Humphrey got out and started shaking hands. It was a lot of fun.
What was he like as a person?
Well, of course, I didn't get much chance to talk to him, but everybody said he was very nice and they liked him.
Was it the same with Nixon?
I was only on Nixon twice, so I didn't get any information. But when I worked on Hubert H. Humphrey, at that time he was vice president, then running for president. So So he got all the double protection he could get.
Here is another musical segment called Different Worlds, composed by Russian composer Edgar Ahrens.
Following is from West Side Warrior, the memoir of Ray Boylan, a Korean War veteran and crime fighter. He was there fighting in the world's coldest battlefield when the Chinese communists invaded.
Desperate squad members ran past our foxhole yelling, "Get the hell out of here! There's too many of them!" Again, we saw the Chinese soldiers charging in with opium-induced mindlessness, oblivious of our bullets. Again, we heard the bugles and whistles. Climbing out of our foxhole, Bob dropped two hand grenades behind us, and I threw one over my shoulder. Bullets whizzing by our heads, Bob and I became bolts of lightning flashing across the mountainside. Like a hideous film, desperate scenes like this played out on the Tokong Pass for 3 days. Sometimes I played in the scene. Sometimes I could only watch and wonder if it were real, or if I'd be suddenly jolted out of my trance by an RKO usher saying, "Hey, did you kids sneak in here?"
To acquire this book, Google westsidewarrior.boylan.kindle. Boylan is spelled B-O-Y-L-A-N. That's West Side Warrior, Boylan, Kindle.
Nowadays, if you are a serious business person, just getting assistance from someone with a license and a bit of experience may not be sufficient. In fact, your realtor actually needs to be knowledgeable enough to be one of your top advisors. Whether you are facilitating a giant merger or selling your company, there's a lot at stake besides your finances. There is the future value of your current investment, financial freedom, integrity, and overall reputation. If you need this kind of assistance, Sandra Laflamme is a real estate expert with the experience, reputation, and knowledge qualified to assist you in all your key transactions. Sandra Laflamme, real estate services with integrity and conscience. Contact her today at 888-366-8070. That's Sandra Laflamme at 888-366-8070.
This is Johnny Blue Star. In this segment, we will hear Ray Boylan discuss some of the surveillance skills he honed as a crime fighter, but also talk about our novel series called The Foot Soldier. The first book, Boots in Manhattan, is now available in Kindle. Just go to Amazon and put in keywords, Boots in Manhattan, Boylan, and Blue Star. Boylan is spelled B-O-Y-L-A-N. Here is What Goes Around, a fascinating song by singer-songwriter Stephanie Slevin.
Close your eyes, embrace me, feel tomorrow's end of night.
Did you feel that there was any special danger during this time? I mean, since it had been after the Kennedys were assassinated?
I always felt the element of danger, and I was always on my toes. I was very, very cautious and careful, because anything could happen anytime at any moment.
Speaking of times like that, what would you say were some of the more dangerous situations that you were in during your career?
Well, one of them was about the time when I was following these two guys that were stick-up artists. We decided to take a tail on them for a Saturday morning, and we followed them from their home. Another guy showed up with a car that turned out to be stolen, and they went out. They were headed out to Long Island. So we wound up in the one of the shopping center out in Mineola, and as I said, the car was stolen. They all got in that car, but before they got in that stolen car, we saw them reach over the back seat and take guns and put it in their belts. And then when they get out of the car, they put hats on, fedoras. So we were following them around the area, didn't know where exactly they were going. Then all of a sudden, they stopped by a Corvettes. And it just so happened there was a armored truck there, dropping off money or picking up money, I don't know. But anyway, I figured, well, this is it. They're going to take that armored truck. And so me and the group, we had about five guys with us, circled the truck, and I always heard it was safe to take your gun out and put it in your pocket, coat pocket, so you'd have it ready. But the next thing we know, there was a cop came to direct traffic. This was during Christmas time, and a cop came to direct traffic. So all of a sudden, these guys disappeared, and they got away from us. They were gone. So at least they didn't pull the armored car sticker. But later, we found the car, the stolen car, behind a bank, Meadowbrook National Bank. And one of the guys went in the bank to just search it out, and he met a guy in there, a fella he knew as an FBI agent, and he was speaking to the FBI agent, and the FBI agent said, well, this bank was stuck up for three times in the past, so they just put a guard on it this weekend. So we figured that's what spoiled a stick-up. We didn't know it was going to be the bank, but thought it was going to be the armored car, but anyway, a cop on the traffic spooked them, and they left. That's close to danger there.
Well, another thing that you did, and this will be, it's towards the latter points in your career, you were sort of like an emergency medic, right?
Yes, I worked on the EMS ambulance in Jamaica, New York.
You see, all these places you're talking about where I grew up, so I'm thinking about Mineola, where my father's office was, and
yes.
Jamaica was, right, you know,
Queens.
Passed it on the plane, on the train all the time.
Oh, sure.
Railroad. So tell us a little bit about that period.
Well, I had I was a standard first aid member when I first started, so I could only drive the ambulance. I couldn't attend. But, of course, I helped the EMS guy who was stationed with me. And then I had to go to school to get an EMS license. I get a license by the state of New York. Then I could help assist in recovery of people. One time, we were called to a gang fight, and one of the young members had a paring knife stuck in his head, in front of his head. So we had to take him back. He lived, unfortunately. I put in my book a little incident that a couple of the guys in the area tried to jump in the ambulance and on the ambulance, and I had to throw them off. And then I thought, oh my God, they'll be waiting for us in the parking lot of the hospital. But Nothing happened. And then another time, the Van Wyck Expressway was closed for repairs. And at 11 o'clock at night, some drunken driver went around the barrier and drove down the road and hit the back of a payloader truck and drove three of the members up into the truck. All were DOA when I got there. And let's see... One time I responded to a shooting in Jamaica, and I was not driving that time. So the driver dropped me off at the house because the cops were saying, down the block, down the block. So he went with the ambulance down the block. And then I had some cops right there surrounding the house. I said, where's the victim? So they said, she's in the house. It's a woman. And so So I went up to the door, and all of a sudden, a shot rang out right past me, right through the door. And I ducked, and I said, what did them guys tell me that this guy was in there with a gun? The story goes that he was a landlord, and he was trying to recover rent from this girl who lived there. And he gave her a hard time or whatever. She called her brother, and her brother came over and started an incident with the guy, and he shot her brother. And her brother ran down the street and dropped dead a block away, and shot the girl. The girl was in critical condition by the time we took her back to the hospital. Well, that's a one.
Why don't we just talk just for a minute about the work we did on that novel?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, sure. I'm not 100% familiar with everybody in there because the names didn't stick in my head.
But that's okay. See, we took this the background of the movie from a lot of things that actually happened to you.
Yeah, I know.
And we kind of blew them up. What was it like to actually see yourself and some of the events in your life portrayed fictionally as well as actually as they happened, as it was done in West Side Warrior?
Well, I enjoyed writing or putting my thoughts down and reading your thoughts in the novel. It gave me a real outlook on what a good novel could be.
Yeah, it was sort of like I found your story so intriguing that I kept seeing these fictional scenes. At some point, we sort of made a transition, and then we thankfully made a transition back and finished and published West Side Warrior.
Yeah.
But it was quite an interesting experience because I never written anything that was fictional that was so close to reality in some ways, and yet quite different. And I found it interesting to see whole scenes appearing in my mind that were connected with your life, but they were not really part of your life. They were really created.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, sure. It was very interesting.
Did you feel like when you were when you got into combat, was there from the beginnings in boot camp to you going out and working with the Marines in training in amphibious warfare, from all that until you got into combat, was it fairly much a straight line? I mean, were you fully prepared for what you experienced when you actually entered into combat?
Oh, well, as I say in my book, that when I first landed, I felt like I was on a maneuver. And although there were a few snipers around in the area of Incheon Beach, when we went forward and I walked past Gimpo Airport, there was a bloody battle there, and I saw all these North Korean soldiers half buried, and I could see their faces, and I says, this is for real. I finally got the visualization that I'm in a dangerous situation, and it's going to be me or him sooner or later.
When you enlisted and during the time you were in training, did you really think you would be going into combat?
No, never. I was in about 20 months, 24 months before Korea broke out. And it was all peacetime training, and I was in a reconnaissance company where we were out on the beach most of the time in rubber boats and actually enjoying it. But I was in the Mediterranean on occupation duty when in June when Korea broke out. And eventually, of course, sometime about early September, we were shipped to Japan to train, get additional training to go to combat in Korea.
So it was kind of a shock.
Yes, it was. I never thought I'd be going to war, but I never was afraid. I always thought, well, I'm going to be okay, and I'm going to get home in one piece.
Boots in Manhattan is a coming-of-age novel by Ray Boylan and Johnny Bluestar. It is about a young Tom Boots Raymond who grows up in New York in the 1940s, who is a member of a street gang.
My friends and I were about to start our own game of stickball when Rabbit Lacey, the head of the Rattlers, came up to us and tried to move in on our game. We were called dwarves, the youngest members of this stupid gang.
Hey, Kevin, I need you to get some gloves and some stuff I left at my place.
No, this is our game.
Hey, are you my good little dwarf or what?
You've been calling me a dwarf since I was six. We're not your personal slaves, pal.
Hey, what is this? A dwarf rebellion? All right, big guy. We ditched the dwarf thing. We make you guys regular rattlers.
No, it's too late.
He looked at Jay and me. We looked away. Rabbit was now angry, and he pushed Kevin hard with the palms of his hand. Kevin tried to ram him in his stomach, but he stepped aside, throwing Kevin into the curb where he fell to the ground, bleeding profusely at the knee. Still, he managed to get up.
My street.
Kevin shouted at Rabbit, pointing at him with an angry index finger.
Find out more by Googling Boots in Manhattan, a 1940s coming-of-age novel, part one of the novel series The Foot Soldier by Ray Boylan and Johnny Bluestar. Google with the words Boots in Manhattan, Ray Johnny Kindle. That's Boots in Manhattan, Ray Johnny Kindle.
New Galaxy Enterprises is a media company specializing in wide-ranging content like novels, nonfiction books, screenplays, commercial advertising, web content, etc. One of our most esteemed providers is illustrator Robert W. Zalo. I work on all my most important projects like book covers, logos, web design elements with Robert. As an illustrator, he worked on the Ignatz-nominated comic book, The Expert's Guide to Killing Things That Go Bump in the Night. His skills encompass advertising, magazine illustrations, gaming, comic books, TV production, and scenic painting. His clients include Comcast, Adelphia, Haven Talent, Forceworks, High Octane Theater, Star Creative Advertising. If you wish to contact Robert, go to johnnybluestar.com and let me know. That's johnnybluestar.com. For artist, illustrator Robert Zalo, an essential component of all the work we do. Maybe he can help you too.
It has been a great honor to present to you our interview with author Ray Boylan. His book, West Side Warrior, available on Amazon, not only is an exciting story, but contains a photographic record of Ray's life and times. Through it, you will meet one of the most amazing people I've been privileged to meet, giving you a picture of the honorable and dangerous task undertaken by both our military and crime fighters during the whole of the American experience. At this point, following the interview, Ray said,
"Well, listen, Ray, thanks a lot for talking to me today."
Okay, and I appreciate it. Thank you very much for helping me write my book.
And today, I also thank Ray for letting us air this very special program. I also want to give a special thanks to my partners and associates, Patricia Welch and Edgar Ahrens. And finally, an homage to the great Hassan Khan, who has helped me with the websites, the YouTube promotions, commercials, and many other elements supporting this show. Thank you again, Hassan Khan. We will go to the final break with Patty Greer's amazing tribute to this wonderful earth we live in. We want our planet back. And we'll see you next week on Threshold Radio.
It's falling in our eyes. and it's getting harder to see the beauty that is our world and the freedom to be free. It's landing in the water, we know it's in the air. It's time for you and me to show we care. Say no to GMOs, hiding in our food, and no to fluoride in our water too. Charge here. Let's save this family and do what's right for Earth and you and me. Step into the new way,
into the new way,
where we live in harmony. No more war, no more fracking, we are free. Let's do it differently. Sickening all the people, and it's killing all the trees. It's falling in our eyes, and it's getting harder to see the beauty that is our world and the freedom to be free.